Hello and welcome to the Advanced Age Roleplay Gamers podcast. I'm Nathan, I'm one of your hosts, and I've got Matt with me tonight as a co-host. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
And we are graced with a special presence. You may notice on the screen one Anthony Gupo, our sometimes cast member when we can grab him. So thanks for joining us, Gupo. I brought him on because we've got we're going to talk actual play tonight. We're going to talk video production. We're going to talk, kind of get into the guts of producing a super high quality, high concept actual play. And I thought Tony's background with being a professional filmmaker, video producer, like daytime job guy, he could make us look smart. So good luck with that. So Brian, we've got Brian Holland with us.
I was just going to say the other half of that is that Anthony's probably going to make me look dumb because I've done this like one and a half times. So,
well, yeah, he's only done like little things like this owl documentary, something about superb owls. I can't remember what that was, but, I know it's nature documentary. Somebody may have heard of that before, but, anyway, so,
nobody got that joke.
I did.
Smart people will get that joke. Smart people like Brian will get that joke. And see, a joke I can make without embarrassing Tony too much because he doesn't really talk about that stuff. But anyway, but we're not here to talk about Tony. We're here to talk with Brian from Chaosium, and we're here to talk about Graveyards of Arkham. Welcome, Brian. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. It just hit me a moment ago that I've been invited onto the Advanced Age Role-Playing Game podcast. Yep. I want to say I don't think I'm of advanced age, although the other day I had my first sort of like aging panic moment when someone mentioned to me that if they rebooted Austin Powers, he would be traveling back in time to the 90s, and that deeply upset me. So the cruel and linear passage of time strikes again. Thank you so much for having me, though. I think last time I saw you all was at Gen Con last year.
Yeah.
And I'll hope to see you again in Meat Space then. So thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to talk about Graveyards.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. We had a whirlwind slew of interviews last time we saw you, and that was our first time kind of interacting with Chaosium, and it was such a pleasant experience. Everybody was super nice, so that's why we're hitting you up again. We only talk to people that we like, so
that's good. I'll put another feather in my cap.
There you go. Yeah. You should feel proud. So Brian, why don't you give our viewers, listeners, a little bit bit of a background about what you do with Chaosium, how long you've been with them.
Sure. I've been with Chaosium since the tail end of 2019, so I'm a pre-pan employee, and I'm the marketing director at Chaosium. So while I don't have a strictly creative role, which is something that is obviously when people talk about working for game companies is usually where people are thinking like, oh, you get to hang out and like play games and write games all the time. I get to do that sometimes, but I'm mostly in marketing. But the cool thing is I get to actually then dabble with all of our games, as opposed to if I was in creative, I would probably just be doing Call of Cthulhu or just Pendragon or just RuneQuest, but I get to work with all of them, which is pretty cool. That's cool. As far as Graveyards of Arkham is concerned, I was the one of the executive producers on that series. So we had myself and my boss Michael O'Brien, who we affectionately call Mob, with the EPs, and then our production studio, Good Time Society, who people may know. So that's Becca Scott and Jack Michael's company, and they do. I think they started sort of in 2020, and they were doing Call of Cthulhu sort of Zoom actual play stuff during the pandemic, just when the sort of Zoom version of actual play really sort of took off. People might have been doing it before then, but I have no memory of it personally. Becca is just naturally a huge Call of Cthulhu fan, so we got along very well. And then some years later, we've done a number of things together, and we reached out to them when we wanted to do Graveyards and basically said, like, hey, you know, we want a fully kitted out production studio to bring this vision to life. And we spoke to a few different production studios, and they sort of put their pitch and their breakdown and how everything would work. And we ended up going with them. So that was sort of the initial inception, I suppose.
So this is the second produced actual play you've done. What was the one before it called?
Bookshops of Arkham is the so to be clear, we have done a lot of actual plays, and we have sort of funded a lot of actual plays as well. So Bookshops of Arkham was actually done by a different production studio, and they were in Atlanta, Georgia. I believe they did change their name recently. I believe they are now Elder Eye Entertainment. I'm pretty sure. Look that up. I can't remember if that was the name they changed it to or the name that they used to have. Either way, you'll find them if you Google them. And that was a co-pro, so a co-production between us and our licensee partners at Roll20, which is the virtual tabletop. That means that we both contributed the same amount to fund that production. But we had on our end a very light touch with that. So when it came time, you know, a little, because that series was received very, very well on our YouTube channel. We wanted to, we talked about wanting to do another series. For longevity purposes, we wanted to make a few changes. The first was, obviously everybody was like, oh, I want to know what happens to the Bookshops of Arkham characters. Like, what happens then, et cetera, et cetera. Firstly, we knew that we had the Call of Cthulhu Arkham book coming out this year. And we wanted the story for Graveyards of Arkham to be really woven into what we were producing with that book. So this time around, the writing team, which is the same team, and when I say writing team, this is not suggesting that this is a scripted show in any way. It is, it's just like in the way that you would run a scenario or a campaign. The people that wrote the campaign, Darren Ormandy and Belinda Cornish, who have both got many accolades. Like, Belinda is a longtime stage and theater performer. Darren Ormandy, he works in the games industry. He actually works at Weta Workshop in New Zealand at the moment. The folks who make, and he's working on the upcoming Lord of the Rings game. Favorite fact about Darren, which I only learned a few months ago after knowing him for a few years. Am I right to assume that you gents have probably seen the 1999 cinematic masterpiece, The Mummy? Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
Seen The Mummy? Do you remember the Book of the Dead in The Mummy? It's like this big black book, and it's got like a key that you open. He made that prop. Anyway, so very, very cool. Anyway, we basically sent them a very early draft of the Arkham book and said, hey, this is the sandbox campaign setting. We want you to use this when writing the campaign. So that was the first thing, is we wanted it sort of more integrated with one of our products, and also the Chaosium version of, you know, Arkham County, I suppose. The second thing is, again, for longevity purposes, I didn't want to do a Bookshops of Arkham Season 2. We wanted to do something that would allow us more freedom to change things in the future. So similar to the program like American Horror Story, where every season is its own contained story, and maybe there are some same actors playing different characters, we instead went with Graveyards of Arkham, Bookshops of Arkham. Maybe we'll do Butchers of Arkham, or, you know, Delicatessens of Arkham, or something like that going forward. But that just allows us to switch things up. Primarily, this was because we weren't sure if we were going to be able to get all the returning cast members, and it turns out we couldn't. We could only get two of them, which was Patrick and Lucia. And the other thing was, for a bunch of reasons, we couldn't work in Atlanta, Georgia. We wanted to work in Los Angeles. One of the reasons is that Los Angeles is a direct flight for me. So
yeah, I can imagine.
And it's a long one. Yeah, so yeah. that makes a big difference. The other thing we did this time around was a Kickstarter to help fund the production. And that decision was made primarily because, looking at the data of people who watch Bookshops of Arkham, from what we could tell, most of these people didn't actually play Call of Cthulhu. So what we wanted to do with the Kickstarter was, because all the Kickstarter rewards were PDF copies of the Call of Cthulhu rulebooks. So the idea there was that, hey, you can essentially get these rulebooks in PDF at a discounted price, and at the same time help us fund the second season of the show. And we funded in like 2 hours, I think, and then, you know, made some extra. But, you know, without getting into too nitty-gritty details, the show did cost a lot more than what the Kickstarter made in the end, as a lot of these things do. So that was sort of the early stage of stuff. And then we ended up filming in September of last year. So after taking my however many hours the flight is from Melbourne, Australia to America for Gen Con in August, I was back for like 3.5 weeks and then had to go to Los Angeles for 6 days. So that was good. It was very fun though.
So yeah, I was looking at what you brought in from the Kickstarter, and that didn't really seem like enough to cover things. How many episodes have you done? Are you
so there'll be 6 episodes, yep. Which all right, so let's let everyone behind the curtain for a second.
Sure,
That was 3 days of filming. So we would film 2 episodes per day at the Good Time Society studio in Burbank, California. And this was I mean for me it was the first time being on like a set for anything, and it was, from my perspective and also talking to other people on set, it was a extremely professional like production, because you know we're based in LA, so all of the crew were people who, you know, the lighting team were a lighting team who work in Los Angeles, which means they work on, you know, television and films and stuff. The sound team, did I say the sound team? Can't remember. Anyway, all the people working on Graveyards of Arkham were industry professionals, which is really, really cool. And like hanging out in the green room with one of the women who was on the lighting team, she was just casually mentioning that this job is much more relaxing than when she has to work on Star Wars. Like, so, which is pretty cool.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tony, do you have any questions off the bat?
First, most important is like, so you're in Burbank, so Tommy Burger or In-N-Out? That's probably the first question.
In-N-Out was
yeah,
was,
In-N-Out, was, yeah, sure.
My thought, at least, yeah.
So first of all, it's great meeting you. The production quality is kind of funny. Look, you know, doing a deep dive, you guys have so much content. You have been the team as a whole, you know, consistency, like, well, you know, it's really hard, right? You know, but meaning hard, and we're you know, my two partners here, like Nathan, Matt, like, you know, just getting it out there week after week, you know, it's really a strong commitment. With all that said, watching these episodes, there's such a high level, you know, it's like far and away, like, you know, when I see them, like, you know, how did they do this? And so one of the first questions I have, and I think you just answered it, is the show pre-baked? But at the same time, when I'm watching it, it has a very, when you say you recorded all those, did you pre-bake them? Meaning, did you, shoot all your ISOs, cut it together, and then how did you did you add a live element after the fact to give it that that spontaneous feed? Because when I watch it, it seems like I'm watching a live feed with some Q&As, you know, so how did you guys achieve that?
Yes, I mean, it was filmed very much, again, from my perspective as, you know, somebody who's not done this before. From my perspective, it was filmed very much like any other sort of production would be filmed. So like there were cuts and there were like, you know, having to reframe things, or maybe somebody, like I was in the green room and I'd come and interrupt a shoot because maybe somebody used the Dungeons and Dragons parlance for rules rather than the Call of Cthulhu ones. So things like that, like, hey, you know, he's not a dungeon master, he's a keeper, like, you know, that kind of thing. So they would cut and, you know, just retake that. In terms of how baked in it was, so the players were still players and they're still doing improv and responding to Mark presenting them the story, and you see, like, even the most recent episode is a good example of, you know, where even our plans for the story change quite a bit, just as they do when you play at home. Like, you if you're running a game, the story won't always necessarily go in the direction you want. I suppose the added difficulty we had was we have some guest NPCs,
yeah,
which, you know, so far in the show have been portrayed by Andrew Lemon and Paula Deming. And again, we've got 3 shoot days and we anticipate, like, oh, so Paula's character is in the second scenario, so she will need to come in for 1 shoot day on day 1. If the players, for instance, decided not to follow up that lead at the library in episode 2, we'd be like, oh, well, sorry, Paula, we can't use you. But obviously that there's a cost involved in that, so we couldn't do that. So it was things sort of like we had to say to the players, like, hey, you do need to make sure you go to this location in this episode, that kind of thing. So the end of episode three, the most recent episode that aired last week, Becca Scott turns up right at the end. Now, the original intent was for her to be in more than half of that episode because we thought, like, oh, the characters will for sure follow up this particular lead and then Becca will be there. But, you know, players will always surprise you. So we had to move things around. So there were a few difficulties like that. We also had an illness on set, which meant that one of the guest NPCs, Cynthia Marie, couldn't come to shoot, which was a big shame. And we were lucky that we had Belinda Cornish, one of the writers, who's also Mark Meer's wife. She's on set with us, and she and I would sort of talk about like how we're going to have to change the story to fit certain things in various episodes or whatnot. But as I mentioned, she is a very well accomplished stage actress, and she was able to take up that role in the end. I am realizing that I'm rambling a little bit. I'm not sure how much I've answered your question, Anthony. So
again, studio professionals, sound, lighting, camera. I'm going to ask you about, and this is getting into the minutiae of as far as like switching, like, you know, what equipment may have been used. But I think, again, to your answer, time is money. You know, you have the studio for, you booked it for how many days? And because of that, how much pre-planning were like, hey, we got the studio for like, well, we have all this wonderful stuff, but we need to knock out.
Yeah.
Let me add on to that. Yeah. Let me add on to that question before you answer, because that's leads into so figuring out what kind of goes into making something like this, there's got to be a ton of pre-production put into it. So if you can answer Tony's questions, but also kind of like, you know, how much time did that take? You know, what are some of the more interesting moving parts in planning a studio production like this? If you could kind of ramble about that for a little bit, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So we are lucky that Good Time Society actually have a studio. They didn't have to rent one. And that is one of the reasons, there's a number of reasons, but that was one of the reasons we ended up choosing them as our production partner. Because they had the studio and it was 3 days of shooting. And there was the, I believe, 1.5 days beforehand for bump in and set deck. And then they did a tear down on the fourth day in their own time.
Would you tell people what that is? Set deck.
So that was the, I'm not sure how many establishing shots there are in Graveyards of Arkham where you see the full set, but, that room where that set is just an empty square room with white walls. So that means that like the fences, the graveyard, the floor, the trees, they were all built and brought in and custom made for this by the production designer, Daniel. And he did a phenomenal job. And this sort of does lead into the other question, which is how much pre-planning is involved. The answer is a lot. So obviously before we went to Kickstarter, we had to have our production partner locked in. So we were talking with the folks at Good Time Society about all the various needs. Probably, I think in late July, like early July, and that was for a September shoot. Luckily, again, they are total pros, and we just said, like, you know, hey, here's what we want for the set. This is the theme. It's about graveyards. There's evil monsters which are associated with moths. Like, this is the end. You know, here's what bookshops look like. Here's what we want to emulate. We don't want to have a table in between players, because that's one of the things that the audience responded to so well, was that there's no tables. We want to make sure that people's iPads are in, like, you know, cool, you know, disguised in some ways, that they might look like notebooks from a distance, all that kind of thing. And they just said, yep. And they took all that and they would send it through to us and say, like, hey, here's a mock-up sketch. Like, we're actually going to build a graveyard. We're like, oh, we didn't ask you to do that, but they did. And it's this really cool sort of optical illusion behind the, yeah, it's bonkers what a good job Daniel did just making all of that. And we just happened to mention, like, oh yeah, there are moths in this story. And he just, you know, if you look closely, you can see in the brickwork, like, there are like fossils of moths in there, and as the series goes on, more butterflies and moths appear in the set around there. When it comes to lighting and all the sound and that kind of stuff, we were lucky in the fact that they knew what Call of Cthulhu was. Becca herself is a huge Call of Cthulhu nut. We said, look, there's obviously a very specific mood we're going for here, and they communicate all that to the lighting team. We show up, you know, and I felt very important coming in and them just saying, is our client happy? Is this what you'd like? You know, made a couple of minor changes. It was a, in terms of the equipment, I can't tell you specific model types of cameras, but I can tell you it was a, I believe a 5-camera setup. So all 5 cameras were filming concurrently, mm-hmm. and then the editing process, which thank the Lord I was not personally involved in, but was taking the feed from those 5 cameras and chopping them up into a coherent thing. So it is, I'm sure people look at it and be like, oh, there's a lot of work that goes on here, but I don't think people realize just how much work is going on there. Like, so when you're watching Graveyards of Arkham, like, it's sort of like that Nathan Fielder meme where it's like, you know, all my friends are just off screen laughing as well. Like, there are like 8 or 9 other people directly nearby who are responsible for all kinds of things, which is probably the other thing that people don't realize is when people say, like, why don't you just do these all the time? Like, it's because they're very expensive, particularly if you... you pay people properly. I think one of the reasons we were lucky to get so many talented folks working on it, not just because we were paying people properly, but we were also filming this. If anyone is familiar, what was happening in the film and television industry in September of last year, is that there was a joint writers strike, and the actors strike was also going on. Now, to be very, very clear, both of those unions had omissions for actual play content. So none of the SAG or Writers Guild members who were working on Graveyards were performing struck work. So that was all A-OK, which was cool. But because so many productions were shut down for various reasons, I think that some of the crew that were working on were just like, oh, good, I've got a gig. Because it was like a follow-on effect from, like, you know, oh, we're shutting it down because... I know Florence Pugh is striking, means we have to stop making the show. It means that the lighting people, the sound people, everybody are out of work as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, because for our current actual play, the artist for it was someone who was affected by the strike and were able to kind of throw some money his way and get some, like, art that we would never be able to afford otherwise.
So. Yeah, it's very cool.
Nathan, I would like to circle back to that feeling that it's live. As far as like the interaction, can you speak to that a little bit?
The feeling that it's live. You mean when you're watching it?
I'm watching, like, oh, I feel like anything could happen here. And so, was that something that by design or?
I think a lot of that probably comes from the fact that the players are still playing a game and they're still reacting to what's going on. And they may have been told a couple of things like, hey, you know, we've got Paula here today, so you kind of need to make sure you go to the library at some point. They still didn't know what was happening. And there's a great example of this in the episode, which I'm not sure when this particular podcast is going live, but at time of recording, the episode that is streaming... streaming for the first time tonight, has a big reveal in it, which the players did not know about. And we made sure we kept this secret on set. We made a point of saying, like, hey, the actors have to leave the room while we install this thing. The Mark actually says to the players as part of the stream, like, hey, players, please cover your eyes while we bring this on set for this, and then open your eyes and react to this thing.
That's awesome.
And we were very excited about that. So, and it's a pretty visceral reaction that the players have. So we do get to do things like that where I think when you're watching actual play, even if you're not watching it like a live stream, you as a viewer can sort of... there's a bit of empathy going on there, because you are also discovering things at the same time as not just these characters that are on the show, but also you know that the players are discovering them at the same time you are. So I think there's a unique sort of, what's the word I'm looking for there?
Definitely a hybrid form of entertainment. So I was watching episode one today, and I it's kind of funny. We've watched everything from just, you know, you run the spectrum between just an audio, right? Audio only, streamed out, all the way to like, you know, you've got like what, like the D&D movie or whatever, right? That's like your other total spectrum of like fan.
Yeah.
But what caught me is, like, I know with our podcast, we do audio, we do video, but it is just us, right? It's just us playing. But I was immediately drawn in that I was both entertained by the storytelling and by the presentation. Like, I was immediately drawn. The characters are wearing costume. They're in voice. Mm-hmm. There's this, and I think not having the table was a great idea. There is this, I don't know. It reminded me of when we've played like How to Host a Murder.
Sure, right?
There was this very comfortable feel. And I was struck by that. This is really, and I don't know how many people are doing it. It's definitely a somewhere in the middle type of entertainment that I found both watching this as entertaining, listening to this as entertaining. It was very interesting. And I just, as a question, right. In a story that someone shoots, like a series, you have a script, people write the script. There's usually not a lot of change. How, given the chaos of players as they are, and how many times, so I would say what you said earlier, the writers were there, right? So how many times did you have to like huddle and go, oh crap, they shouldn't have done X, or they shouldn't have done, like, how many times did you have to like dynamically go, oh, okay, how do we do this? You know?
Yeah. There were some kind of major changes that were made. I'm not going to say in real time, but in between episodes where, you know, for instance, there was, I'm not sure if I can say this depending on where this is going, but there was a point where the characters basically discovered a lead or because they just huddled in the game, they basically discussed like the possibility of X or Y happening. And I'm in the green room watching the feed, and Belinda next to me says, oh no, they're going to figure out this thing that we didn't think they would figure out until episode three tomorrow. What are we going to do? And then, you know, over lunch, Mark and I then talk about like, okay, hey, look, it looks like they're probably going to do this. So maybe we need to sort of change what happens at that location. So to keep the pacing for the story, you know, going. So there were changes like that, which were pretty full on. I think the added layer to what we did with Graveyards has been with the guest NPCs. And we did mention this a little bit a couple of times. But I think the big thing with the guest NPCs is that's a different actor coming in, and they're not a player. They have a character that they portray, but they also know a lot more about what is going on than the players do. So they're sort of an extension of the keeper, or the person running the game in that sense. And I just think it's really cool. Like, I was watching Paula Deming coming on as the character Pippa Franklin, who's this really bubbly woman who is married into high society and clearly does not fit in with high society. And she does an absolute great job at it. But I was just watching it on YouTube the other day, because I was scraping things out to put it on TikTok of all things. And I was just watching and remembering like, oh, like, the player's sitting here looking at her like, oh, you as a person know exactly what's going on, just like the keeper does, but we are interacting with you in a completely different way. And by the same token, there's in episode one, and Andrew Lehman's character, Wallace Phillips, who's a retired police officer, one of the player characters in character says, oh, are you armed? And Andrew just looks at the keeper just to answer the question. He says, it's like, oh, no, you are not, you know, that kind of thing. So it adds a really cool extension. But in terms of the hybrid type of entertainment, I was actually talking to Patrick Logan on set. So Patrick Logan, who plays Archibald Desmond, the doctor who's a World War I veteran, he was saying that as an actor, this is such a unique medium, because it's not like it is full improv, but it's also not fully scripted. He said it's like scripted in the sense that I have a character and I know who I am, and you know, I've written my character's backstory. And I should point out that all the players created their own characters.
Oh, great.
Okay. And he says, and then he's not saying anything that's groundbreaking to people like, you know, you and I who play role-playing games all the time. It's like, you know, what would my character do in response to this situation? He's talking about role-playing. But he says, as an actor, when you're doing that on set in this situation, it is a much more unique and exciting sort of feeling than when it's just, oh, I've just got to remember my lines. I've just got to do this. And it's obviously not the whole, like, I'm walking in and, oh, you know, yes, and I'm not doing full improv either. It's this really cool and unique sort of hybrid. And when you've got games, not that we're big nerding ourselves, but, you know, when you've got games like Call of Cthulhu that deal with more mature and sometimes lofty themes, there's a lot of real meat to dig into there. And I think as the series goes on, we see more of each of these characters. And by the end, you know, it's pretty cool just how hardcore they went there.
Yeah, just thinking about the medium, and as Matt alluded to earlier, there's quite a rainbow of styles of actual play and you know, we're in kind of a weird spot ourselves, but just thinking of it as a you know, you're Chaosium, you're not a charity, you're not like just a guy, you know, yeah. There's got to be some value in it for mm-hmm. for Chaosium to produce this stuff. You're just not, you know, not just being nice guys and, hey, here's some free entertainment. There, you know, there's, I see that my thinking, of course, there's a tie in with the new book, but I guess long term, what does Chaosium get out of, you know, continually funding and producing these high value?
Sure. So I think part of it is, you know, it's always good to have people playing your games. Yeah. When it comes to these, you know, productions that cost tens of thousands of dollars, not to mention the time involved for Chaosium staff like myself, that is more of a, like, you know, this was pitched to Chaosium leadership is like, this is a Call of Cthulhu lifestyle marketing activation. So we are going to show Call of Cthulhu played at the, you know, the highest level.
Yeah.
Pitched as, you know, a lifestyle. These are the kind of things that you can do with this game if you want to, you know, in the same way that you know, Critical Role to some degree is taken, you know, Dungeons and Dragons to that other, you know, next level. I mean, that's the obvious comparison, right?
Yeah.
And there's just the sheer difference, because we put up an actual play from our Stream of Chaos crew, because we actually have an internal crew that stream once a week on our channels, and they stream primarily Call of Cthulhu, and they go through like the various published scenarios that we do, and you know, we get decent viewership, but the just the sheer difference, like the in views and attention that these productions get is really something else. I suppose with Graveyards, the added value this time around was that we can directly tie it into the Arkham book. And like, there are NPCs and characters that you meet in Graveyards of Arkham and locations you go to in Graveyards of Arkham that are literally in the Arkham book. And things like when Mark says, you know, describing the you know, River Town or the part of town that you're traveling to, and the map and images come up, they're all images from the book. So yeah, it's, you know, to be very capitalist about it, this is basically a way to encourage people to play our games and buy into the Call of Cthulhu lifestyle, I suppose. So I know Anthony's had his hand up a couple of times here. Yeah,
go for it, Tony.
You know, with that said, like, you're part of your role, like, as you alluded to with the TikToks and the posting, I think we would be very interested in your strategy, only, you know, it's sort of how much, what is your general strategy, and what's your end goal? And I guess part of that, and then to add to that, is do you have tools like, let's say, TubeBuddy, or things that you rely on for those metrics to know what's working, what's not, or do you have a general sense of strategy that you could maybe share with us?
You mean for TikTok specifically, or for
the market? I think you're marketing in general, right?
Well, I guess. Yeah, probably YouTube TikTok. Mm.
Because part of it's like, here we are, you know, we're gung ho, and you probably hear this a lot from other mm-hmm. podcasts. We're gung ho. We're putting in the talent that we have at our disposal. Again, being working dads and what have you. And so we're just curious, like, if you maybe have some tips on like taking it from a grassroots level and what you would see, what tools you would use or what strategies you may have to like to help folks like at our level to start taking it up a notch.
Yeah, sure. Look, some of my suggestions might be outdated because it's a while now since Chaosium, even when we were growing on socials, was at a sort of grassroots level. And a lot of that was probably built before I actually joined the company as well. Like, so my boss, Michael O'Brien, Mob, he actually started the Chaosium Twitter account, I think in 2016, and he grew it just, he didn't spend a cent. Like he grew that organically. And when I came on, we were at like 19,000 followers. Now we're like over nearly I think 35,000 followers, something like that. He's someone you should ask to about growing your grassroots Twitter account because I don't know how he did that, which is really cool. One thing I would definitely suggest if you are spreading across socials is make sure you're using a scheduling tool so you can, you know, sort of one for one thing, it scheduling stuff, your posts, be they on like YouTube Shorts or Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. Scheduling them ahead of time means that you guarantee to hit them at the times that you know that your target audience is most likely to see them. So for instance, if you think most of your audience are, people who, you know, have a disposable income who are going to be working Monday through Friday, you might want to schedule a post for, you know, between 12:30 and 1:30 when they're likely to be at lunch scrolling through their phone, or at 8:30 in the morning if you think, you know, if you're maybe targeting a group that's in New York and you might schedule a post for 8:30 in the morning when people are most likely going to be commuting on a train and spending their time on their phone, just things like that. The second thing that scheduling allows you to do is do a whole bunch of posts in a significantly less amount of time, because you can just do them like once a week and build it out for the rest of the week, I suppose. One thing that we've noticed is that we just need to keep, not necessarily innovating, although innovation is good, but expanding where you're looking at. So for instance, I mentioned before that I'm posting on TikTok. I don't personally use TikTok. My fiance does. She shows me funny TikToks. It's great. I see it happening. And now it's like, we really need to start doing this, even though I'm pretty sure if you're in your 30s and posting on TikTok, you get put on some sort of watch list. I would highly recommend the thing, like, you know, folks like at the Glass Cannon Network, I'm not sure if you know them, they do a great hectic series of actual play, primarily sort of on Zoom, sort of talking head stuff. No one's dressed up, and it's just really, really good, funny content. And they're really successful with doing their YouTube shorts, which are essentially TikToks, but their YouTube shorts are really, really good. So maybe, again, if you know that your audience is primarily on YouTube and they're not, you know, in the demographic that is using TikTok, start experimenting with posting shorts on YouTube, and because they function very similarly. Like, honestly, like since doing TikToks for us, which has only been maybe about a month now, I make the videos on TikTok and then we actually post them sometimes to Twitter, but also to Instagram Reels. And the attention that these TikTok videos get on Instagram far surpasses the attention that we're getting on TikTok at this stage. TikTok is a wild beast, and everything I read about how to grow your audience and everything contradicts itself everywhere. Everyone's got a different idea on how this works. So, I really think, yeah. So if you've got, you need to have your goal first and then make sure you're maximizing where you think your audience is, I suppose. So I would always rather, take a box of 50 Call of Cthulhu starter sets to a horror convention that has 300 people at it, because I know all those people love horror stuff, than take 1,000 Call of Cthulhu starter sets to a generic board game convention where people might want to buy my game. Does that make sense? I suppose even if the audience is smaller, if you heighten the, you know, if you're the thing that they want to see, you'll catch more people, I suppose. Yeah, so it was all very broad. That might be a whole other podcast though.
And that makes sense, because I was talking to another kind of small independent creator, and it's really, it's, you know, he was producing a very specific type of content, and it's like, I asked him point blank, well, where are the people that want that? And he couldn't answer. And that was kind of, so I totally agree with you. You kind of have to move to where the food is, or you have to be able to identify where the food is.
Yeah.
so before you can go hunting. So, put it again in a more capitalistic, language there.
Exactly. Yeah.
But so it was, I've been doing some ad hoc TikTok stuff, some shorts here and there, some Instagram reels, and the interaction is actually pretty good on some of those places, and so I can definitely see it working out. But it is a ton of work of putting that stuff together on top of everything else. So it's one of those things that you know, smaller creators like us really have to think about, you know, how we're going to create enough content to spread across those different channels. And the idea of a scheduling tool to kind of automate some of that makes a big difference.
And depending on the scheduling tool you use, they actually will send you, I think it's either weekly or might be monthly, but reports on like, hey, you know, the posts that you did on Mondays generally performed worse than the ones you did on Tuesdays. As long as you're on top of like, oh, well, Tuesday we always posted, you know, the show's now live versus Monday we just posted like, here's a funny clip you missed. Maybe we need to change that around or swap those things to, you know, that, you know, you can make change, because it's not an exact science. And I think the important thing for anyone trying to do any of this stuff to remember is that even when you go on and you see like a gigantic TikTok account where it's just like, it might just be one dude who just talks about Dungeons and Dragons at the camera and that's all they are, and maybe they're funny or maybe they're not your sense of humor, but you're like, wow, 8 million people have watched this, really? The thing to remember is that if you scroll, you'll be scrolling for a while, and that this person has spent a long time building up this. I get fed, because I think TikTok knows that I'm a marketing guy somehow. The only TikToks I actually get on the Chaos Team account are from other TikTokers saying like, here's how you get 100 million views with this one simple trick. And I'm like, none of that's true. So I'm not going to click your link. I'm sorry. You know, it just, it takes time. What's the old adage? It's it takes a lifetime to be an overnight success or something like that.
So I guess I mind if I ask, so cast, so you're putting together this sort of a production, right? And so like us, we're just a bunch of yokels that hung out together, right? But you're putting together, this is a professional show, cast. So what's that process like when you're looking for sort of a, you know, still to play, but people who are going to be professional, who are going to be part of these productions, you know, what are you looking for in cast members? Do you do like session zeros? Are there like familiarization sessions before the game to like say, hey, because some of them may or may not have played that particular system. So I was just kind of curious how you, you know, working with on sort of a professional player level.
Sure. So I actually got one of my first jobs in the tabletop games industry was working for Paradox Interactive on Vampire, which was very exciting to me personally, because I'm not sure you can see my shelves behind me, but that's my first role-playing books were all World of Darkness books. And that was cool. So the actual play series LA by Night was something that I didn't work on, but I was helping promote in my role there. And I was only a very junior level sort of part-time role. But then I see comments on the Graveyard streams that are like, oh, like half of these people were in my other favorite show, LA by Night. That's so cool. I'm like, oh, what a weird coincidence. It's almost like I met them and then was like, hey, you know, we should stay in contact. And then that kind of thing. Like, you know, it also helps when you're working with a production studio like Good Time Society. If we just said to them, hey, can you cast this for us as well? Here is the budget. Here are the, you know, we don't want it to be all men. We want, you know, like if we gave them some parameters, they could have come back and just said, yeah, here's the list. What do you think? This time around, because we were going for that anthological feel, we ideally wanted, in a perfect world, we would have had all four people who were in Bookshops of Arcanum come back and play different characters. But scheduling conflicts, travel time. Some people had changed jobs and, you know, didn't have the time anymore. That's fine. So we did manage to get two. So Patrick and Lucia came back, and then we sort of knew for the other two roles, we already work a lot with Nora Ibrahim and Josephine McAdam. And we had a good working relationship with them. And pardon me, both of them had also worked for Good Time Society in the past. So we sort of said, what do we think about these people? That's great. The other reason we were gravitating towards them is because we know that all these people had played our games before. Now, one of the best things about Call of Cthulhu, just to get my salesman hat on, is that it is dead easy to play. If you are a player, it is, I can teach you the game in 30 seconds. Everything you need to know. You roll these two dice, you roll under whatever that thing is, the number is, which means that if you've got a brawl of 50, you have a 50% chance. So all these are percentages. And then that's all you need to know as a player. Congratulations. If you haven't played Call of Cthulhu, you can go play it now. You can't run it, but you can play it. So we are lucky in that sense. So we did do a session zero, which was over Zoom with, I believe it was Mark and Belinda and Darren, the writers, because we basically told the players, you know, please create a character and send them through to us. And this wasn't so much of a, let's make sure you got all the numbers right when you're making your character. But the writers wanted to make sure that the various character backgrounds could be woven into the story where they could. And we wanted to make sure we didn't have any characters that were like, oh, this particular archetype really just doesn't fit with this campaign. And mm-hmm. if you were playing a home game, that would be fine. You can work that out. But when you're playing a game that, you know, we're sort of filming and we don't want to have to take eight sessions to get to the find out like really how you fit in here. We crushed that out. So yeah, we went over things like safety tools and such. But everybody in the cast had been on a set before, so they knew those core differences. We had fun time casting it. I had some other dream people that I would like to have gotten as guest NPCs. So here's a fun fact for you. Andrew Lemon, who's from the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. I'm not sure if you folks are familiar with the HBLHS, but they operate out of Burbank, Glendale, Burbank, somewhere in one of those two in California. They've got and they make all these really, really cool props that are inspired by the original H.P. Lovecraft stories. They do things like audio dramas and the plays that are based on the original Lovecraft stories, and they're huge Call of Cthulhu LARP fans and also Call of Cthulhu fans. They're a licensee of ours, so they make things that are, you know, directly involved with our products mm-hmm. as well. And Sean Branny and Andrew Lemon are also good friends with the actor Nick Offerman. And I still can't find a way to politely ask them, like, hey, do you want to maybe see if Nick, your friend from college, who you tell me is a huge Call of Cthulhu fan, wants to, like, come in and do like a one dayer, just pop in and just like crush, like, you know, just we'll tag him in and he'll shoot 6 3-pointers and then he'll go home. Like, that could be really cool. That is my long-term goal, is to get Nick Offerman on an actual play doing some, I don't know, Ron Swanson style Call of Cthulhu role play.
I could just totally see him as playing like some sort of detective type role or something like that. Yeah. And it would be effortless for him.
Yeah. Well, so the HBLHS actually produced a Call of Cthulhu movie, but they filmed it in the style, like it's filmed as a black and white silent film. And it's, so it's the story Call of Cthulhu, but as a black and white silent film. It goes for about 40 minutes. But they filmed that in Nick Offerman's woodshed. Like, they built the set in there. And so, because they did it, like, it was a full on, like, just amateur production. And it's really cool. If you can get it on their website. You can definitely buy the DVD, but you might be able to buy a download as well. But definitely check that out. And also, spoilers, if you're coming to Gen Con this year, you might have the opportunity to catch a screening of that movie as well.
Ooh, so. Okay. I will look for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good spoiler. Tony, do you have any other follow-ups? Anything else you're curious about?
More than we could fit into the context of this. I can't wait to meet you in person. There's definitely, I think we could have a part two to this, without a doubt. The quality of the show is amazing. It sucked me in immediately. I became aware of it because of this interview, and now I'm a big fan, And
very good. Tell your friends. Like and subscribe.
Exactly.
Smash that like button.
I'm a big fan, and so I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. How does it end again? Oh, no, I'm just no, I'm really looking forward to seeing how it all turns out. But I'm again big fan. I can't wait to see where it all goes.
Well, one thing I just want to ask you, Anthony, because I know you've worked in film and TV before. Have you ever worked with a crew member whose job title is flesh artist?
The closest I can answer to that question was at the Adult Film Awards in Las Vegas in 1967.
Okay.
Have you worked with somebody with that?
All I wanted to say was that there was actually a crew member whose job on Graveyards of Arkham was flesh artist. And I can't tell you why just yet, but when you see it, you'll know. I'll just say that. So keep watching.
Yeah. So that's going to be a great business card.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jack Smith, flesh artist.
No follow up questions. Great call,
yeah. I'm looking forward to spotting that reference. That's great. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, Tony does have a flair for the horror, so I'm sure he'll get a kick out of that. I got to send you his fake commercial for the fishing
the Needle Death 2000. I can't heap enough praise, but for me, you guys have hit postmodern jukebox meets War of the Worlds via Orson Welles, and I think that's a great place to be, where the quality of the performances are everybody plays off each other in an amazing, on a high level. And again, it just speaks like, I want to play the game. Like, you know, I'm just gushing all over you, you know, but it's true. I think it's, you know, really within the first 5 minutes of reviewing, like, oh, I get it. I'm in, you know, so again, high mark. It's great.
Well, thank you. And can I use that quote about the postmodern jukebox meets War of the Worlds?
Done.
That's a good one. Thank you.
Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu's got, I mean, you could probably go out to anyone who's, like you said, people who have never played TTRPGs and talk about H.P. Mm-hmm. Lovecraft, Call of Cthulhu, and there's going to be millions of people who are completely into it. So that's great. There's already like a great audience out there for that. But given some of the other genres, things like fantasy that are kind of in rise right now, I don't know how long that'll last, right? Before we're all having to hide the fact that we, you know, but would Chaosium, so given this sort of, you know, it's costly, there's a risk associated with it. Is this a model that's really built for the Call of Cthulhu only, would there ever be consider, or have there been discussions ever to do something for any of your other major titles?
Yeah, like RuneQuest or
Yes. So, I mean, the short answer is I think Chaosium is most well known for Call of Cthulhu. And without getting into the nitty gritty, I think you can all assume that the reason for that is because Call of Cthulhu is our number one product. And yes, there are big costs involved in things like this. So basically, it is. It really just comes down to, I would love to do a Pendragon specifically, or RuneQuest production on this same level, with a beautiful like Glorantha themed set, and everyone's, you know, dressed up like Glorantha cultists, and they've got the tattoos done by professional like Hollywood makeup artists. Would be so, so cool. I have to convince my bosses to spend the money on that first, I think. So it's baby steps. Definitely not out of the realm of possibility. But right now, Call of Cthulhu
Can I speak on behalf of if you send us $500, I'm going to go to the local dollar store. We're going to make your pilot. Right? Okay. You need a proof of concept, right? And I think we're the people to do that. And if we go into one of your garages, we could do this. And I'm very excited to at least try. I just wanted to.
You give Tony $500, he's going to take a marker and just draw all over us the tattoos.
I've got a loincloth right back there. I can put it on right now.
Well done.
But so I think one of the nice things about doing this, you know, to kind of enhance the brand or the your product lines. So when people see the players interacting in Arkham and they kind of get a feel for, you know, oh, you know, what's going on in the graveyard and everywhere else, they kind of, it feels more lived in. So when they go back to their table, they kind of, it feels like a real place that they've seen before. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, I could see it being a hard sell for your boss, but that's just the kind of thing that if, you know, especially with Glorantha, there's so many different cults and gods and everything. There's a lot to it, but, and there's like, you know, whole history books that are like that thick. And I think just being able to have a high production of something like that could really introduce and bring people into that world and make it feel lived.
No, you don't have to convince me, Nathan. That's right. I agree completely. I think there's a whole, I would say, generation of people who maybe have. If they've heard of RuneQuest, they probably haven't played it. And when I came on with Chaosium in 2019, and I first started looking at RuneQuest, I was sort of blown away. I'm like, how, this game should be far more popular than it is. Yeah. And I think that the biggest thing is just what you mentioned, all the different gods and the different cults and how they're arguably sort of like the closest thing you have to a character class is that's the cult you choose. And coming from a background with vampire, like that's to people, you know, in so millennials and younger than us, one of the things that we gravitate toward was and also people who played it in the 90s, to be fair, but the idea that, oh, that clan, that's my clan, I associate with that clan, I get to do that, that's my happy place. RuneQuest is that on crack. Like, you can be like even more individual because there's like 300 cults. Like, you're not going to run into someone, another, you know, agar-nagar cultist necessarily at a convention, right? And so, yeah, it is a slow process where the RuneQuest line, like the team has been bringing out some breathtakingly gorgeous RuneQuest books, especially the last couple of years. I just got my personal copy of the Lunar Way book, arrived like 2 days ago. I've just seen the proof PDF of the Dragon Pass book, which is coming out later this year. And yeah, so we are continually growing it. And no, I think it's definitely on the cards to do something like this for RuneQuest. We'll know more once Graveyards finishes and we have as much data as we can and then go from there. But I will note that the host of the AARPG podcast we have the full endorsement. So,
yeah, well, we have to build our own studio, right, Tony?
Exactly. Yeah.
But so you've been super generous with your time. I really appreciate talking to you again. We're going to pick up this conversation again in August when we see you at Gen Con. Any closing thoughts for us, Brian, before we let you go?
No, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for your very interesting, insightful questions. Thank you for not making fun of me, Anthony, specifically, because you've worked professionally in this environment before, and I haven't really. And yeah, I can't wait to see you folks at Gen Con. And yeah, honestly, I'd love to do something like this probably leading up to Gen Con when I'm more free to talk about all the exciting things we're actually doing at the show this year,
okay. which I can't talk about this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, thanks everybody for watching and listening to us. Thanks, Tony, for showing up on time. thanks, yeah. Matt, as always, for putting up with me. Listeners, we love you. Please make sure to tell your friends that we're awesome and we're not too creepy.
And go watch Graveyards Arkham.
Subscribe and watch the show.
Hey, I got to go and post some things on TikTok right away. So, thanks again, everybody. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, folks. Appreciate it.